From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air Weekend. Today, Edward Snowden, the former National Security Agency contractor who leaked documents to journalists that revealed the U.S. government's comprehensive domestic surveillance program.
AT&T stores phone records now for people in the United States going all the way back to 1987. If you've got kids or you yourself are born after 1987, they have every phone call that you ever made.
Also, Andrea Mitchell, chief foreign affairs correspondent for NBC News and anchor of her own MSNBC show, looks back on her career. Mitchell is known for asking powerful people tough questions, sometimes shouting the questions.
Mr. Minister, are you sure the Trump administration will be strong against Vladimir Putin?
Did you have to learn how to have a really big voice?
I don't think I had to learn that.
And Justin Chang reviews the new film, Ad Astra.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from State Farm, whose agents know that your car and home are more than just big purchases. They're a big part of your life. You put the time into making them your own. So now it's time to protect them with your own personal State Farm agent. Not only do they truly get you, but they'll be there for you when you need them. And with over 19,000 agents in neighborhoods across the U.S., there could be one just around the corner. More at statefarm.com or 1-800-STATE-FARM. State Farm, here to help life go right.
To privacy advocates, our guest Edward Snowden is a hero, a whistleblower who exposed abuses by government intelligence agencies. To others, he's a traitor who exposed national security secrets. Snowden was an IT systems expert working under contract for the National Security Agency in 2013 when he provided three journalists with thousands of top-secret documents about U.S. intelligence agencies' surveillance of American citizens. The revelations made Snowden a wanted man, accused of violating the Espionage Act. They also led to changes in the laws and standards governing U.S. intelligence agencies and the practices of U.S. technology companies, which now encrypt much of their web traffic for security. Snowden has lived for the past 6 years in Russia, out of the reach of American law. He's written a new memoir about his life and his experiences in the intelligence community. It's called Permanent Record. Snowden spoke to Fresh Air's Dave Davies from his apartment in Moscow via an internet connection.
Well, Edward Snowden, welcome to Fresh Air. I want to begin with the suspicion that some have that you are a tool of the Russian government or collaborating with Russia. Since this happened in 2013, we've seen, you know, the Russian interference in the U.S. election, its collaboration, according to the Mueller report, with WikiLeaks and getting stolen emails to affect the election. And I think there's just a general belief that in this authoritarian state, Edward Snowden wouldn't be able to live for 6 years unless he were useful to the Russian government. What's the general answer to that?
Yeah, I think this is for a lot of people who have sort of a Hollywood understanding of how international affairs and intelligence works. But the reality is, even in the case of, as you said, electoral interference, in the case of WikiLeaks, the Mueller report, the United States government itself never alleges that, for example, WikiLeaks even knew that they were talking to Russian intelligence. WikiLeaks' entire system is designed so they don't know who is submitting documents. And even granting that they came from Russian intelligence, that was in fact the case. Every newspaper in the world thought these were newsworthy stories. The New York Times, the Washington Post, everybody was reporting on this. When you look beyond sort of the standard examples that we look at in the case of electoral interference, and we look toward my case, there is that question. If he's not cooperating with the Russian government, why would he be allowed to stay? And I think the answer here is actually quite obvious. Russia doesn't need to do anything, or rather, the Russian government doesn't need to do anything to look good in this circumstance. It shows that they have an independent foreign policy to their public, because I applied to all these other countries in Europe for asylum, and all of their governments, unfortunately, could be threatened to revoke their expressions of support. And this happened, this is a long and well-reported campaign where every time a country started to lean towards letting me in, it would be either the Secretary of State or the then Vice President of the United States that would call their foreign ministry and say, look, if you let this guy in, we're going to retaliate. And Russians very much consider themselves to be a European country. So if the rest of Europe is afraid to do something, and Russia is not afraid to do something, that makes Russians feel good. And remember, we did this in reverse to Russia and the Soviet Union for the last 50 years. So, of course, if we have an example or an instance where the whole world sees basically the United States government is not living up to its values, the Russian government is going to be very eager just to underline that. That's all they need.
Do you receive any financial support from the Russian government?
No. This is one of the things that, again, is a common misconception. People sort of think about my life. They think I'm living in like a bunker. There's Russian guards. The Russian government and I have any contact whatsoever. They're paying me. No, I have my own apartment. I have my own income. I live a fully independent life. I have never and will never accept money or housing or any other assistance from the Russian government.
You didn't exactly have a typical adolescence. You ended up spending nights on the computer, school not of great interest to you. You tell the story of looking at the website of the Los Alamos National Laboratory, you know, that did all this nuclear research, and discovering that anybody with a little understanding of computers and directory systems could get internal memos. You looked at confidential memos that were just available. You called the general number in the lab and left a message and said, this is a problem. You eventually got a call back. Tell us about that.
So my mother gets a little bit of a rude awakening because she's making dinner and I'm sitting in the living room on this computer. And she picks up the phone and says, yes, he's here. And she turns and looks at me. And as I see her hearing the other side of the call that I can't hear, her face just gets pale. And she looks at me and her eyes grow wide. And she covers the receiver and she says, what did you do? And when I get up out of my chair and I pick up the phone and this man says, I'm from Los Alamos Nuclear Laboratory. These were the sweetest words anyone could have told me in a moment, because I'm like, oh, thank God. Because I had left that message, because I had called them, because I hadn't really done anything wrong. I had simply been curious, and as a Boy Scout, I had called this facility and said, hey, there's something broken on your website. You should do something about that. My mother did not punish me for this. In fact, she was very proud of the fact that I told them they had a weakness in their website. And Los Alamos, for all things, once they realized I was a child, I think they had been expecting someone older. They said when I turned 18, I should give them a call.
You had a lot of jobs in the intelligence community. You were actually a CIA officer in Geneva for a while. You ended up in Tokyo after that, and then Hawaii. And you write that the material that you distributed to journalists ultimately documented an array of abuses so diverse that nobody was ever in a position to know all of them. To find out even a fraction, you had to go looking. And what set you looking was an assignment to do a presentation about China. You want to explain this?
So, I'm invited to give a presentation about how China is hacking the United States intelligence services, defense contractors, anything that we have available on the network, which I know a little bit about, but not that much about, because they have the person who's supposed to be giving the presentation drop out. So I go looking. I use my network access to pull all of the slide decks, all of the presentation, all of the training that's previously been given. I pull all of the recent reporting on what's happening, and I work late into the night seeing what exactly is it that China is doing. What are their capabilities? Are they hacking? Are they doing domestic surveillance? Are they doing international surveillance? What is occurring? And I'm just shocked by the extent of their capabilities. I'm appalled by the aggression with which they use them, but also in a strange way, surprised by the openness with which they use them. They're not hiding it. They're just open and out there saying, yeah, we're doing this. Yeah, you know we're hacking you. What are you going to do about it? And I think this is a distinction. I think, yes, the NSA is spying. Of course they're spying. But we're only spying overseas. We're not spying on our guys at home. We wouldn't do that. We have firewalls. We have tripwires for people to hit. But surely these are only affecting terrorists, because we're not like China. But this plants the first seeds of doubt where I see if the capability is there, perhaps somewhere hidden deep, even inside the United States government, the appetite for how they can use these capabilities remains the same.
Right, so you explore further, and what do you discover about what the NSA is actually doing?
So over the final years of my career, I see that we have the same capabilities as the Chinese government, and we are applying them domestically, just as they are. We have an internal strategy at the NSA, which was never publicly avowed, but it was all over their top secret internal slides, that said the aspiration was to collect it all. What this means was they were not just collecting and intercepting communications from criminals, spies, terrorists, people of intelligence value. They were collecting it on everyone, everywhere, all of the time, just in case, because you never know what's going to be interesting, and if you miss it when it's passing by, you might not get another chance. And so what happened was every time we wrote an email, every time you typed something into that Google search box, every time your phone moved, you sent a text message, you made a phone call, increasingly the United States government, without giving the public a vote, we weren't allowed to know this as a public, but in secret, the boundaries of the Fourth Amendment were being changed. This was without even the vast majority of members of Congress knowing about it. And this is when I start to think about maybe we need to know about this. Maybe if Congress knew about this, maybe if the courts knew about this, we would not have the same policies as the Chinese government.
We're listening to the interview Fresh Air's Dave Davies recorded with Edward Snowden. His new memoir is called Permanent Record. We'll talk more after a break, and Justin Chang will review Ad Astra, the new science fiction drama starring Brad Pitt. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air Weekend.
This message comes from NPR sponsor OnStar. If you're ever facing vehicle theft, OnStar can help with stolen vehicle slowdown. An OnStar advisor can work with law enforcement to help locate, slow down, and recover a stolen vehicle quicker and safer. OnStar, be safe out there. Requires select paid plan, cell reception, GPS signal, and working electrical system. Doesn't prevent theft, damage, or loss. Details at OnStar.com.
Let's get back to the interview Fresh Air's Dave Davies recorded with Edward Snowden, a former IT systems manager who worked under contract for the National Security Agency. In 2013, he gave three journalists access to thousands of classified documents describing U.S. intelligence agencies' surveillance of American citizens. Snowden spoke to Dave through an internet connection from his apartment in Moscow.
So I want to talk about your decision to release these access to many documents to three journalists. And just talk about why you took the course you did and why some critics say you had other options. One thing people say is, look, there's a system. There are inspector general's offices of each of these agencies. Why couldn't you go to them?
Well, this is a great question. For one, we've never seen the inspector general's office actually be an effective safeguard for the Constitution itself. We have had, since I came forward, one of the inspector general employees, I believe the deputy inspector general for the NSA, come forward and said, if Snowden had come to me, I would have explained to him his misconceptions about how these programs worked, how these things are in fact legal, how these things are in fact constitutional, and maybe he wouldn't have had to do this at all. The inspector general is a great resource to have. If someone is a middle manager and they're engaged in sexual harassment or they are embezzling or something of that nature. But if you have a criminal conspiracy inside not just the leadership of the NSA, but in fact in the White House that is run by the vice president's own lawyer in the Bush administration, Dick Cheney had a lawyer named David Addington who said building this mass surveillance system in the very first instance was legal, when in fact he knew that was not the case. What do you do? This is asking you, the hens, to sort of report the fox's misbehavior to the fox himself. And I want to point out just real quickly that it's not a contention that these programs were illegal, that these programs were likely unconstitutional. That's not my assertion. That is the assertion of the very first federal court, I think a ruling of Judge Leon, in the wake of these disclosures prior to the revelations of mass surveillance in 2013, the government A, said these things weren't happening, B, if they were happening, they were legal, and C, why are you even asking about this in the first place?
The description in the book of how you worked through how you were going to release this material and how you contacted the journalist and provided it is really fascinating. We won't have time to go into it here, but I want to talk to you about some of the specific arrangements you made. Three journalists were provided with access to thousands of documents that you had. What conditions did you impose on their use? What did you tell the journalists about what they could do and not do?
When we looked at what happened, what produced this, the system of checks and balances failed. And so if I had come forward myself and said, look, this is wrong, this is a violation of the Constitution, I'm the president of secrets, and I'm going to decide what the public needs to know, and I just throw it out on the internet, which wouldn't be hard for me. I'm a technologist. I could have done this in an afternoon. There's a risk implied in that. What if I was wrong? What if I didn't understand these things? What if it was, in fact, legal or constitutional, or these programs were effective rather than, as I believed, ineffective, which later was confirmed by the Obama administration. These programs weren't saving lives. They had some intelligence value, but they didn't have a public safety value. At least that was meaningful. So what I did was I tried to reconstruct the system of checks and balances by using myself to provide documents to the journalists, but never to publish them myself. People don't realize this, but I never made public a single document. I trusted that role to the journalists to decide what the public did and did not need to know. Before the journalists published these stories, they had to go to the government, and this was a condition that I required them to do, and tell the government, warn them, they're about to run this story about this program, and the government could argue against publication. Say, you've got it wrong, or you've got it right, but if you publish this, it's going to hurt somebody. In every case I'm aware of, that process was followed, and that's why, in 2019, we've never seen any evidence at all presented by the government that someone's been harmed as a result of these stories. That's why I believe these stories won the Pulitzer Prize for public service. It's because there is a way that you can maximize the public benefit of a free press and them aggressively contesting the government's monopoly on information, at the same time mitigating the risks of even a very large disclosure of documents by simply making sure that you trust the right people, the right sector of society, with the right system to keep everyone honest. Because all of us work better together than we do alone.
You know, I will say that on that question of whether this has harmed American interests or put people in danger, there was an AP story last year which quoted a spokesman for the National Counterintelligence and Security Center as saying Snowden's disclosed documents have put U.S. personnel or facilities at risk around the world and damaged intelligence collection efforts, exposed to tools used to amass intelligence, etc. Are they wrong?
They are wrong. Look, I can't correct 6 years of lies in, you know, 60 seconds. But when you look at all of those claims, they're always merely allegations. The government has never put forward any evidence, and they have investigated me for 6 years. So has basically every other government on the planet. And you, a journalist, know better than anyone else that the government aggressively leaks when it's in its favor. You can look at this White House right now. If if disclosures of classified information, just hard stop, caused damage, if they created risks for U.S. personnel or programs, three-quarters of the White House would be in prison right now. They're not, because the vast majority of leaks, while they are uncomfortable, while they are embarrassing, or sometimes beneficial to government, far more is classified than actually needs to be. So yes, the government has made those allegations and they will continue to make those allegations. But look, the thing that we always have to ask is, what is the evidence to back that assertion? And they've never provided that, and I'm quite confident they never will, because it didn't happen.
You fully expected to be identified. You eventually identified yourself to explain your motives. As you were planning this, what kind of future did you envision for yourself?
The likeliest outcome for me, hands down, was that I'd spend the rest of my life in an orange jumpsuit.
But in prison?
Yes, but that was a risk that I had to take.
Hmm. So now you've been in Moscow for 6 years. Lindsay Mills has joined you. You are now married. You live in a two-bedroom apartment. What kind of security precautions do you take? You didn't want to go to a studio for this thing, for this interview, right? You're pretty careful, aren't you?
Yeah, well, I run my own studio because, you know, people ask how I make my living. And I give lectures. I speak publicly for the American Program Bureau, and places book me to speak about the future of cybersecurity, what's happening with surveillance, and about conscience and whistleblowing. But I do, you know, I've never been the nightclub type. I'm a little bit of an indoor cat. whether I lived in Maryland or New York or Geneva or Tokyo or Moscow, I'll always spend the majority of my time looking into a screen. So yeah, while I'm out on the street, I try not to be recognized. I also live a much more open life now than I did back in 2013, because it seems the consensus has resolved that anyone who tries to kill me is only going to prove my point.
Hmm. As somebody who knows a lot about the kind of information that can be gleaned from a cell phone, I'm wondering what precautions you take with your own cell phone use?
First off, I try not to use one as much as possible. And when I do use one, I use a cell phone that I've myself modified. I perform a kind of surgery on it. I open it up with special tools, and I use a soldering iron to remove the microphone, and I disconnect the camera so that the phone can't simply listen to me when it's sitting there. It physically has no microphone in it. And when I need to make a call, I just connect an external microphone through the headphone jack, right? And this way the phone works for you rather than you working for the phone. You need to be careful about the software you put on your phone. You need to be careful about the connections it's making, because today, most people, they've got 1,000 apps on their phone. It's sitting there on your desk right now or in your hand, and the screen can be off. But it's connecting hundreds or thousands of times a second. If you, some of your audience is listening to this on podcasts right now, through, for example, earbuds, they know their screen can be turned off. It can be sitting riding in their pocket along with them. They don't even have to be looking at the phone. But it's still very much active. And this is this core problem of the data issue that we're dealing with today. We're passing laws that are trying to regulate the use of data. We're trying to regulate the protection of data. But all of these things presume that the data has already been collected. What we need to be doing is we need to be regulating the collection of data, because our phones, our devices, our laptops, even just driving down the street with all of these systems that surround us today, is producing records about our lives. It's the modern pollution. It is invisible, but it still harms us.
Let me ask you one other question. You've lived in Russia for 6 years now. Do you see yourself making a life there, or do you hope to come home someday?
My ultimate goal will always be to return to the United States. And I've actually had conversations with the government, last in the Obama administration, about what that would look like. And they said, you know, you should come and face trial. And I said, sure, sign me up. Under one condition, I have to be able to tell the jury why I did what I did. And the jury has to decide, was this justified or unjustified? This is called a public interest defense and is allowed under pretty much every crime someone can be charged for. Even murder, for example, has defenses. It can be self-defense and so on and so forth. It could be manslaughter instead of first-degree murder. But in the case of telling a journalist the truth about how the government was breaking the law, the government says there can be no defense, there can be no justification for why you did it. The only thing the jury gets to consider is, did you tell a journalist something you were not allowed to tell them? If yes, it doesn't matter why you did it. You go to jail. And I have said, as soon as you guys say, for whistleblowers, it is the jury who decides if it was right or wrong to expose the government's own law-breaking, I'll be in court the next day. Unfortunately, the Attorney General at the time sent back a letter saying, you know, that sounds great, but all we can do for you right now is we will promise not to torture you. So I'd say negotiations are still ongoing.
Although you haven't actually negotiated since the Obama administration, right?
Right. We're waiting for their call, but the ball is very much in the government's court.
Edward Snowden, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Edward Snowden spoke to Fresh Air's Dave Davies from his apartment in Moscow. Snowden's new memoir is called Permanent Record. Their interview was recorded Tuesday morning. Soon after, the news broke that the U.S. Justice Department filed suit to recover all proceeds from Snowden's book, alleging that he violated non-disclosure agreements by not letting the government review the manuscript before publication. Snowden's attorney, Ben Wisner, said in a statement that the book contains no government secrets that have not previously been published by respected news organizations, and that the government's pre-publication review system is under court challenge. The new science fiction drama, Ad Astra, stars Brad Pitt as an astronaut who sets out on a dangerous voyage to the outer reaches of the solar system. It's the latest picture from the writer-director James Gray, whose earlier movies include We Own the Night, Two Lovers, and The Lost City of Z. Our film critic Justin Chang says Ad Astra is a space odyssey that sometimes stumbles, but ultimately soars.
The title of Ad Astra, James Gray's gorgeous, muddled, and weirdly entrancing space epic, is a Latin phrase that means to the stars. It's a fitting name for a movie set in a not-so-distant future where space travel has become ever more advanced, even as planet Earth is in peril. Electrical storms are wreaking havoc throughout the solar system, and the fate of humanity rests on the shoulders of a skilled astronaut named Major Roy McBride, played by a quietly soulful Brad Pitt. Roy is a man of swift action, few words, and great inner calm. In one harrowing early action scene, a high-altitude explosion sends him falling to Earth, and his pulse barely accelerates as he deploys his parachute. Roy is more comfortable floating in the vast, sterile emptiness of outer space than he is on solid ground, where he has to deal with the messiness of feelings and relationships. He recently split from his wife, who was fed up with his workaholism and emotional detachment. Roy inherited both those qualities from his father, Clifford McBride, a legendary astronaut who vanished 29 years ago on a deep space mission in search of intelligent life. But one day, Roy is called in by two top generals who have some startling news for him about the source of the electrical storms, known as the Surge.
Major, what can you tell us about the LIMA project?
First manned expedition to the outer solar system, sir. Some 29 years ago.
And the commander was?
He was my father, sir. The ship disappeared approximately 16 years into the mission. No data was ever recovered. Deep space missions were halted after that.
Roy, we have something that might come as quite a shock to you. We believe your father is still alive near Neptune.
My father's alive, sir?
We believe so.
Roy, the Surge seems to be the result of some kind of antimatter reaction. Now, the LIMA project was powered by that material, and your father was in charge of it. Now, we're talking about a potentially unstoppable chain reaction here.
The uncontrolled release of antimatter could ultimately threaten the stability of our entire solar system. All life could be destroyed.
Roy's mission is to travel to a military base on Mars to transmit a secure message to Clifford and persuade him to stop the Surge. But first, he'll have to head to the moon, which has morphed into a grungy capitalist dystopia, a giant shopping mall surrounded by a wasteland crawling with pirates. There's a gripping chase sequence in which some of those mercenaries pursue Roy in rickety vehicles across the lunar surface. Later, there's a frightening scene aboard a spaceship to Mars where Roy makes a shocking discovery, a reminder that humanity's desire to conquer new frontiers can have disastrous consequences. These little jolts help break up a long, episodic narrative that shuffles genres at will, starting out as a futuristic noir before shifting into an action movie, a paranoid thriller, and finally, a cosmic male weepy. Ad Astra can feel both overwritten and underimagined. I wish there were less of Roy's incessant voiceover monologue, and more of a sense of how this mind-bending, often downright kooky vision of the future came to be. The story becomes even more disjointed once Roy arrives on Mars, shot in a bold red palette by the cinematographer Hoyte van Hoytema. Although I did love Natasha Lyonne's hilarious one-scene performance as a disgruntled Martian office worker. James Gray is often regarded as one of the film industry's last remaining classicists, a director of smart, stirring, grown-up entertainments built on Hollywood's most enduring myths and genres. He's working on his biggest, most expensive canvas to date with Ad Astra, and while the strain shows at times, he also displays an ambition that feels increasingly rare in big studio movies, as well as a desire to stir the audience's emotions honestly and respectfully. At its best, Ad Astra marries the meditative space odyssey of Solaris to the downriver madness of Apocalypse Now, with Tommy Lee Jones playing the movie's Colonel Kurtz figure as Roy's elusive father. There may be something unabashedly ridiculous about the idea of a man saving the world by traveling millions of miles to be reunited with his long-absent dad, but it's in that mix of absurdity and sincerity that Ad Astra finally transcends its lapses and approaches the sublime. Like Gray's previous adventure epic, The Lost City of Z, this is a surprisingly critical portrait of masculinity in crisis. It's about neglectful fathers and needy sons and the often unbridgeable distances between them. The most striking of the movie's many effects may be Pitt's performance, which couldn't be more different from his recent work in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. In that movie, Pitt was all swaggering physicality. In Ad Astra, he's almost otherworldly in his stillness, holding the camera's gaze with eyes that seem to contain multitudes. He shows us a man getting back in touch with his deepest emotions, and makes that experience deeply emotional for us in turn. If that's not a sign of intelligent life at the movies, I don't know what is.
Justin Chang is a film critic for the LA Times. He reviewed the new film, Ad Astra. Coming up, we talk to NBC and MSNBC's Andrea Mitchell about her long career covering politics and foreign affairs. She's receiving an Emmy for Lifetime Achievement. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from the American Jewish World Service, working together for more than 30 years to build a more just and equitable world. Learn more at ajws.org. Support for NPR comes from WHYY, presenting the podcast Eleanor Amplified, an adventure series kids love and will make those summer road trips a little easier on everyone. Hear reporter Eleanor outwit crafty villains and solve mysteries as she travels the globe to get the big story. Available where you get podcasts or at WHYY.org.
My guest, Andrea Mitchell, will receive an Emmy for Lifetime Achievement Tuesday at the News and Documentary Emmy Ceremony. She's NBC's chief foreign affairs correspondent and anchor of MSNBC's Andrea Mitchell Reports. Over the years, she's covered Congress, the White House, presidential campaigns, the State Department. She's reported from around the world, including war zones. She's asked tough questions to presidents and dictators. And various powerful people have tried to get her fired. Mitchell is also a trailblazer for women journalists. She started her career in 1967 as a, quote, copy boy at KYW News Radio in Philadelphia. She became famous in the city for her tough coverage of a tough and divisive mayor, Frank Rizzo. Her reputation for asking tough questions and for shouting them if necessary has continued through her career. Andrea Mitchell, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations on your Emmy. You have certainly earned it.
It's such an honor and a little bit overwhelming, something I did not expect. But I guess if you live long enough, you get awards like these.
Not necessarily. It takes more than living long enough. I want to play a pretty recent clip. I mean, you are famous for asking tough questions and standing up to powerful people, not backing down, not being intimidated. This is an example of that. And it's from 2017, about 7 weeks after President Trump was inaugurated. And this is a kind of famous moment in your career. Rex Tillerson, then Secretary of State, had not answered questions from reporters in his public appearances. And he was doing a photo op with the Ukrainian foreign minister at the State Department. And you just started shouting questions at him. And at the end of this clip, we will hear you being escorted out of the room. So here's Andrea Mitchell trying to get Rex Tillerson to answer her questions.
Mr. Secretary, China has said there will be consequences for the deployment now of anti-missile defenses in South
Thank
Korea.
You.
Can you respond?
Thank you.
Can you respond to
Thank
our?
You.
Excuse me, Mr. Secretary. Can
Thank
you respond
you.
To the threats from China?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Minister, are you sure the
Thank
Trump
you.
Administration
Thank
will be strong
you,
against Vladimir Putin?
Thank you, guys. We're leaving.
They haven't been in yet. So
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Andrew,
can you assure us that Russia
Andrew,
will not be able to move further in Ukraine?
Andrew,
we haven't had any time in here.
I'm sorry,
but we
need to
go.
Let's go, guys.
Okay. Describe what we're not actually seeing, because this is radio. What's happening to you physically as you're trying to answer, to ask these questions?
You can hear the shutters of the still photographers,
mm-hmm.
and I'm being taken by the arm, you know, and just escorted out politely. And they're telling me that the time is up, and I'm trying, and we're backing out. I'm ducking under the camera, trying not to get in the camera's way, and just trying to get an answer. And this had followed months of asking politely, face-to-face in one off-the-record session, and then proceeding to ask, you know, why can't we have access? Why can't we travel with the secretary? He wasn't taking reporters on the airplane. This was the first time since Henry Kissinger, who traveled with the press corps, that the State Department press corps was not in a pool, traveling, paying our own way with the secretary around the world. And for months, at least, I traveled commercially, trying to keep up with a military jet, which was impossible. And the fact that Tillerson did not want the press corps to be involved really hurt him. And so I finally went to a photo opportunity and tried to get a question in, and you heard what happened.
Did you expect him to answer?
I did, because I think that when confronted face-to-face with someone, usually you could get an answer, and we shouldn't have to ask questions chasing White House officials across the North Lawn after they've made an appearance on Fox News on their way back to the briefing room, when the briefing room is there for daily briefings. And I think that it really hurts the American people, and it hurts the administration. Rex Tillerson could have amplified America's message to the world if he had taken the press with him.
You've been a trailblazer for women in journalism. When you started your journalism career in the late 1960s, did you consider yourself a feminist? Had you thought about the lack of equality that women had, and how you'd have to fight to have a career in journalism, and how important it would be as a precedent to have that fight?
I was forced by circumstance to feel that I was going to have to fight for it, because the very first job that I got was being denied to me. I was ready to join the management trainee program in this broadcast company, and they said, but you can't be in the newsroom. And I said, well, why not? And they said, because we've never had a woman do that. You can go into advertising or, you know, promotion, which I didn't have any interest or skill for. So I said, well, let me have an entry-level union job as a copy boy, which is what they called us, copy boys. And they let me become the first woman copy boy, ripping wire copy, which was then printed on a teletype. I mean, when you think of the transformations we've had in technology just in the years that I've been as part of this profession, but there were no other women. They weren't role models. I can recall Pauline Frederick was the UN correspondent for NBC Radio. Barbara Walters was at the Today Show, transitioning from being one kind of host to finally fighting her way to get, you know, past the male anchors who were stopping her from asking news questions. And fortunately, when I got to Washington, there was Leslie Stahl and Cokie Roberts, whom we just lost, and my great friend Judy Woodruff, who made so many things possible for me by having gotten to the NBC News Bureau first, before I did, and then being so welcoming, and we worked together on the White House beat and did so many other things in the years since.
What were some of the preconceptions you had to fight about women?
The preconceptions initially were that women could just not do hard news, that they had to do women's social news, you know, fashion, food, family. And it was defined very rigorously that women couldn't cover politics, women couldn't cover, you know, the military. And better women than I, who preceded me, started breaking down those doors. And And certainly by the time I got to NBC, 41 years ago, there was a woman White House correspondent, but very few others. And so it was really still a challenge. I did consider myself a feminist because there were so many barriers. I had a very strong mother and older sister and father who kept telling his daughters we could do anything we wanted to do and encouraged us in every adventure.
You've referred to the conflict you've felt about wanting to be nice and wanting to be liked and, on the other hand, asking really tough questions and knowing that that's not going to endear you to, to the person you're asking, that you're going to get a lot of grief for that.
I do want to be liked, but when it comes to asking a tough question, I think I don't hesitate, that instinct takes over or determination takes over, that you never forget that your role is as a reporter first.
Is that what you told your mother when she criticized you for being rude, shouting questions at presidents?
Well, she really didn't like that I shouted questions at Ronald Reagan because he would be going to the helicopter or coming back from Camp David from the helicopter, and that was the only chance we had when we went months without a press conference. And so, yes, we shouted questions, and sometimes he would stop. Often he would pretend that he couldn't hear. Sometimes he couldn't hear, but often he would just point to his ears and point to his watch and signal that he couldn't hear. But I recall that my very first press conference with Reagan in 1981, I had come only a few months into his administration right after the assassination attempt. I started filling in more with Judy Woodruff and the late John Palmer, who are our White House correspondents, and I got to a news conference, and I prepared a question, but I was, you know, cautioned not to expect much because I was going to be sitting way in the back of the East Room, you know, under the cameras in the last row, and he called on me, and I later learned from his staff that he actually said when he looked at the picture book, and he had not memorized the names of the correspondents, none of them, except, you know, maybe a few of the front row folks. He kept looking. He said, "No, I want to call on that nice woman who keeps shouting questions at me." And no. And then they showed him my picture, and he said, "That's the one I want to call on." And they said, "No, you don't," because they already knew me. But he did. So he called on me at that very first news conference, and thank goodness I had a question ready.
What do you consider to be your biggest showdown with the president?
I think the biggest showdown I had was actually with the chief of staff, Don Regan, over Iran-Contra when I asked a question of the president at the news conference. This was Reagan, and it was 1987, and I asked a question about the revelation that Israel had helped with money for the Iran-Contra operation illegally, and he answered incorrectly, and they had to put out a correction 20 minutes later while we were still in primetime coverage. So right before 9 o'clock, the news conference ended at 8:35. They issued a written statement. The president misspoke. He corrected himself. I ran it out to the lawn to get it to my colleague, Chris Wallace, who was on the air with Tom Brokaw, and got down below the camera angle, handed the statement to him so he could get it on right before 9 o'clock, ran back to the small cubicle in the back of the White House briefing room that we had, that each of the networks have, and the phone was ringing, and it was Don Regan, the chief of staff, cursing me out for asking the question, saying he was going to get me fired. It reminded me of Frank Rizzo, the mayor of Philadelphia, who had bullied me so much, and I was really scared. And there have been other instances. I asked a question at a news conference of Bill Clinton about whether he was going to live up to his commitment to permit gays in the military. He had just taken office, and he stared me down, and it set off a huge storm, which led to Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So asking tough questions, you know, that's what we do. They get mad. We have to do our jobs. They don't like being pressed when there are scandals. And as long as you're respectful and have your facts right, you push ahead.
How would you compare the kind of anger when Don Regan tried to shut you down to, for example, when President Trump tries to take away White House credentials of a broadcaster or calls journalists the enemy of the people?
I think it's much more profound now. There, I'm sure, have been lots of threats, private threats in the past, anger at reporters individually, but for the President of the United States to call the news media the enemy of the people is to tell his supporters, to tell the world, that that is his view of the Fourth Estate. It is to diminish respect and credibility, respect for the media and the credibility of the media. The result of this campaign, which is now very targeted during the re-election campaign, is to make people not believe us when we fact-check him. And he has to know that a lot of what we are reporting contradicts him. And he just this week said that he never said that he would meet with Iranians with no preconditions. He said it on camera and on Twitter a week ago, and so did his Secretary of State.
And it's being shown now, all the time on television now. It's like he forgets that he said it in front of a camera and there is a record of what he said.
And it's astounding, but he has a bigger megaphone. And when he says fake news, now you hear dictators around the world speaking about fake news. It's a term, and enemy of the people is a term that goes back to Joseph Stalin, if not earlier.
Do you feel like your boundaries are shifted a little bit in terms of like subjective things that you could say about this president because the norms have been shattered, because he's shattered so many norms, because so many people are so concerned about the direction he's taking the country in and about, you know, even about war that we might, you know, inadvertently, accidentally get into or intentionally get into, perhaps through a tweet. Has that changed your confidence or your ability to give, like, opinion or to share concern?
It has changed my ability, and I'm not comfortable with it. I was raised in journalism where you would just deliver the facts, provide the context, rely on your knowledge to say that this is likely to happen or that is likely to happen, or this is true or not true, but you didn't feel that every day you had to be of necessity correcting the President of the United States or the press secretary for false statements. And it's not a position that I welcome at all. I think his use of Twitter and his accusations and the personal attacks have required us to be much stronger in fact-checking and correcting the record. And it is not healthy, I don't think, for us to be in this adversarial situation. It's appropriate for us to challenge and provide context, but I don't enjoy this at all, but I think it's an obligation. I think we owe it to our readers and viewers and listeners to point out what is true and what is not.
You're, I think, 5'3". I am shorter than that. I know there was at least once when you had to stand on a box for your report in order to be seen by the camera with the right shot. Have there been more instances of that where you had to, like, stand on a box?
There have been so many instances. I've stood on boxes all over the world. You do what you have to do. I've stood on ladders. I've stood on tables. I've stood on boxes. But the advantage to being short, because there is an advantage, is that if you're trying to be seen and shout a question at a president of the United States, you can crawl under the tripods of the camera crews, pop up on the other side on the front line, and not get in the way of the camera.
How often have you done that?
All the time.
So a lot of people are used to you crawling around the floor, or used to be used to you doing that?
Yeah, it's one of the things that is less than dignified. But if you've got, in the old days with Sam Donaldson, Bill Plant, these, you know, tall guys shouting questions behind the cameras, if you're 5'3 or less, you do what you have to do.
Did you have to learn how to have a really big voice?
I don't think I had to learn that. I recall that one of the chapters in my book is called Designated Shouter, and that was my job for many years at the Reagan White House, was shouting and trying to be heard over a helicopter.
Andrea Mitchell, thank you for this interview. Thank you for your reporting, and congratulations on the Emmy you will be receiving next week.
Terry Gross, it's such an honor to be with you. Thank you so much.
Andrea Mitchell is NBC's chief foreign affairs correspondent and anchor of MSNBC's Andrea Mitchell Reports. On Tuesday, she'll receive an Emmy for Lifetime Achievement at the News and Documentary Emmy Ceremony. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Roberta Shorrock, Mooj Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.